It's Monday, November 21st, 2011, and this is For Good Reason.
Welcome to For Good Reason. I'm DJ Grothy. For Good Reason is the radio show and the podcast produced in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation, an international nonprofit whose mission is to advance critical thinking about the paranormal, pseudoscience, and the supernatural. My interview this week is with Professor Richard Weissman, longtime friend of the JREF and an outspoken skeptic and public science communicator. But before I get to the interview, I want to invite our listeners to support the JREF's Season of Reason campaign, which we just launched. This year, the JREF has had some measurable success advancing its mission in the media and with educators and at the grassroots. We were in the New York Times, the LA Times, NPR, ABC News, Forbes, Discovery News. More than 4.5 million people watched us take down paranormal scams and actually test psychics on ABC's primetime Nightline, their Beyond Belief episode. We distributed JREF in the Classroom modules to teachers this year. We've done a lot of digital publishing. You can find more about the books that we have made available for the iPad and Kindle and Nook on our website, randi.org. Of course, we hosted the biggest skeptics conference in history with 1,670 supporters of science and critical thinking at the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. We sponsored grassroots workshops in cities around the country. We appointed new JREF research fellows and provided scholarships to students who focus on skepticism in their academic fields, and also grants to a number of educators. Randi toured the world lecturing this year, a 9-city tour of Canada, talks throughout Norway, talks in Spain, several appearances in the United States. And our JREF YouTube channel is now the 10th most subscribed nonprofit channel in all of YouTube history. So the point is, we're trying to do a lot to advance science, critical thinking, skepticism, but we can't do it without your help. So please go to randi.org and support our Season of Reason campaign today. Now for the interview. Richard Weissman, he started out as a magician. He was one of the youngest members of the Magic Circle, the esteemed British Magic Club. He currently holds Britain's only professorship in the public understanding of psychology at University of Hertfordshire. He's written a number of best-selling books, including The Luck Factor, Quarkology, 59 Seconds. He's joining me on the show to talk about Paranormality, a book I think every skeptic needs on her bookshelf. Richard Weissman, welcome to For Good Reason.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Your new book is Paranormality. You've spent decades studying this stuff, the paranormal, pseudoscience, parapsychology. First off, Richard, let's ask you why, if you believe that all of it is nincompoopery or nonsense, why in the world are you spending so much time researching it?
It is an excellent question, because you'd think after 20 years I'd just given up. And I think for me, the key question is, why do people have these rather weird experiences? What do they tell us about the brain, about belief, about our behavior? And that's the direction I've taken with Paranormality. So it's not a debunking book. It's not saying, hey, look, here's experiment after experiment, investigation after investigation, saying these things aren't true. Its starting point really for pretty much every chapter is, okay, let's assume that the psychic isn't psychic, that ghosts don't actually exist, and when people have out-of-body experiences, they don't actually go anywhere. What does all of this tell us about ourselves? And so that's the starting point for the book.
Well, Richard, if that's your starting point, that seems to admit then that this is a debunking book. If that's your starting point, rather than saying, I don't know one way or the other, let's see where the evidence leads, I'm open-minded in case this stuff is real. That's not your starting point. You're beginning with a conclusion or an assumption, let's say, that this stuff is bunk.
Well, it's a conclusion which is based on research. So I'm not saying, hey, look, you know, I'm completely close-minded. There's no way that telepathy could exist, so let's not bother looking at the evidence. I guess what I'm saying is, having looked at the evidence, I'm not convinced. And I'm not going to bore readers with page after page of yet another study that shows that telepathy doesn't exist. I don't think that makes for a good popular book. I think it makes for a good unpopular book, but that's not what I'm trying to write. So I think what I'm saying to people is, hey, look, you know, I've looked at this stuff. I don't think ghosts exist. I could tell you why I don't think they exist, but I think it's more interesting to say, you know, a quarter of the population, certainly in the UK, probably a little bit higher in the US, have ghostly experiences. So now we have a tension. Now we have a sense of jeopardy. You have scientists saying this stuff doesn't exist and people experiencing it. And the question is, how do you square that circle? How do you look at that question in a way that it tells you something about yourself, which then has implications for your everyday life? So that's the angle I've taken.
I loved hearing how you got started in all of this. It was through Susan Blackmore, right? The psychologist, the author. She's a parapsychologist, or at least was. And she was your, what, inspiration for all of this?
I think inspiration would be a good term. I actually got started in magic when I was very young, when I was about 8. And I'd go and see my grandfather at the weekends. And he showed me just one trick, which was a very good trick, which involved a coin vanishing and appearing in a sort of nest of boxes, which were tied up with elastic bands and string. And because of that, I got into magic. From there, I then went, like lots of magicians, looking at the paranormal and became quite skeptical and also kind of disinterested in it for the reasons that we've spoken about, that you think, well, none of it's true, so there's nothing to be done here. And then I guess when I was about sort of probably 17 or 18, I turned on the television and by chance up came this woman with bright red hair, and she was saying, hey, look, I don't think any of this stuff is true either. But her take was, let's have a look at why people believe in it, why they have the experiences that they do. And I've spoken to Sue about this since. We think it was what's called an open university program over here in the UK. And that really changed things for me. I suddenly thought, you know, there is work to be done here. There are questions to be answered. And so that's what led me really in the direction for the next kind of decade or so in terms of my psychology.
And now you're Britain's only professor of the public understanding of psychology. You're a public science figure, not only focusing on the paranormal, even though this is a big area of your research.
Absolutely. So my kind of mission is to take what I think is relevant research in academia and in psychology and get it out there into the public domain, and particularly in my instance, into people's lives. And I think that the rational approach, although it's not very popular within matters of the paranormal in terms of people don't like to be told that ghosts don't exist and so on, when you apply it to other areas like self-help, as I did with 59 Seconds, or with luck, with the luck factor, suddenly it's a much, much easier sell. Because there you're saying, hey, look, you know, you can go into a bookstore, you can see all of these books on how to be happy, how to be more productive at work, how to communicate better. You have no idea whether any of them are actually true. So let's have a look at the psychology, let's see what it says, and let's, you know, try and come out with some techniques which are actually evidence-based. And that was the premise for 59 Seconds.
Hmm. And this book, it's kind of in the same general theme. You're applying the scientific research practically for people's lives, but this book, you're covering the whole wide range of paranormal research. That's fortune telling or telekinesis, spirit communication. You talk about ghost hunting, really the whole field of paranormal research. Let me ask you, is there one of these aspects of the paranormal that is more appealing for you than the others? I mean, in the sense that it yields more for you as a researcher into why we believe this stuff than the other areas of the paranormal?
It's a very good question, and I guess I would go with ghosts, which I think is a fascinating area. So we conducted a survey when the book came out, and around about 1 in 4 of people claimed to experience a ghost. The vast majority of them saying that essentially this was an episode of sleep paralysis. They wake up in the middle of the night, they feel they can't move, there's a ghostly figure at the end of the bed, and they assume they've had a spirit visitation. Now, that can be a terrifying experience if you don't understand the psychology behind it. The psychology is pretty straightforward, that when we dream, we're paralyzed, so we don't act out our dreams and hurt ourselves. As we drift from dream state into waking state, some of the sort of bizarre dream imagery comes across, and sometimes so does the sense of paralysis. Mm. So you end up being conscious but paralyzed, and sometimes seeing a weird figure. And if you don't understand about the psychology of sleep, that can be a terrifying moment. Now, if you do understand what's happening, it's not nearly so terrifying. So I think that's an area which is fascinating. If you look at something like ghosts in haunted houses, there you have people who often are scaring themselves. And when we become afraid, a few things happen. First of all, the blood goes from the extremities to the sort of major organs and major muscles as you prepare to run, which can make you feel very, very cold. And second, you become hypervigilant. So you're listening out for footsteps or even your own heartbeat that you wouldn't normally notice. And when you do spot it or hear it, then you become even more afraid, which makes you even more hypervigilant, and that can lead to a sort of panic attack.
So it's like kind of a scary feedback loop. You get more scared the more scared you get.
Absolutely. And that just builds and builds until people panic, and then they suddenly rush out the room and can't sort of stand to be in there and so on. And that's how these places get the reputation they have. So you can take something which appears to be fairly frivolous, which is seeing ghosts and haunted houses. And when you start to drill down, you realize there is a psychology here. There is a science. And that really is the sort of main thrust of paranormality.
One of my favorite sections of your book deals with near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. I don't know if they're exactly the same thing, but they seem to be lumped together. Believers point to this field in paranormal research as possibly the best evidence that the soul can actually survive the body's death. But in your research, you see other compelling explanations, not unlike this, the sleep psychology or the sleep science you were just talking about.
Absolutely. And again, out-of-body experiences are absolutely fascinating. There is no doubt that people have the feeling that their soul has left their body. When the psychologists have carried out experiments where they've placed targets on top of wardrobes and cupboards and said, okay, we need you to float up and tell us what's there, suddenly people aren't quite as accurate as you might expect if they were really outside their body. Mm. So again, there's no evidence they actually do leave their body. What we know is that the brain constructs a sense of self based on information from the senses, particularly vision and also touch. And that when you're sleeping or if you're taking drugs, you habituate, particularly with touch, to that incoming sensory information. And suddenly the brain doesn't quite know where you are. And if you have a very good sense of imagination, then it can actually send you places that you're not. And in the book, and I should say the book is, as far as I can make it, immensely interactive. There's lots of experiments for people to do. Mm-hmm. And one of them involves a fake arm where you can actually send, as it were, your sense of self into the arm. It's a very straightforward experiment to do. You just need a kind of rubber arm from a joke store. And then you can send yourself into the arm. So you think this rubber arm is yours. Because I think, again, for me, what makes skepticism interesting is when it becomes hands-on, when it becomes something people are doing rather than just talking about. So I wanted to try and give readers that experience as much as possible.
And basically bring it home, make it practical, not just something people debate over a drink, but make it real in their lives, yes.
Absolutely. So something they can do to show their friends. So I encourage people to hold Ouija board sessions and have ghosts spell out their names on bits of paper. And then when you turn those bits of paper face down and mix them up, suddenly that the ghost can't spell their name anymore. It's a kind of fun experiment for people to do. And also that sense of them being informed consumers when it comes to psychics. I mean, I find it amazing that people go along to psychics not knowing anything about the kind of mind tricks these people use, and they essentially place their lives in the hand of someone who is, you know, unqualified, no counseling background normally, and they just go along with whatever that person says. So the really the most contentious area in the book is saying, here are all the tricks of the trade which mediums and psychics use. Now, you may not choose to believe them, but at least know about them before you go along. And I think it's that area that's upset most people in the UK, mainly the psychics.
And you go so far as to actually claim these are the methods that the psychics, the fake psychics, are using, as opposed to saying these are methods you would use if you wanted to duplicate their abilities, but you're not accusing them necessarily of chicanery. You actually go further. You say you believe they're using these magic tricks to beguile their sitters or their clients.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very explicit about that, and also with the psychokinetic work, where I'm saying, you know, this isn't just an alternative explanation. This is the explanation. So with psychics, I talk about the cold reading, the population stereotypes, and selective memory, and so on, saying, yeah, pretty much, you know, there are courses out there, there are books out there, there are DVDs out there, you know that people consciously fake it and other people unconsciously fake it. But know that this stuff, how it works, before you decide to follow someone's advice.
Mm. When you cover psychokinesis or telekinesis, which is moving objects with one's mind, you actually get into Uri Geller, his spoon bending, what researchers used to call Gellerism, when he was kind of at the pinnacle of his career and people considered him worthy of scientific study. And you actually teach a way that some of these people seem to bend metal with their minds. You reveal the magic trick, in other words. So two things. First, do you ever feel a little skittish about revealing magic tricks to a non-magician audience? And two, isn't it at least conceivable that Geller or these other claimants aren't using the methods you reveal to demonstrate their axis spoon bending? In other words, you're using a magic trick and they're doing something real.
It's always a possibility, and I should say in the book I talk extensively about James Heidrick and not about Geller, because I think Heidrick is a more interesting and colourful character. But still, you're absolutely right. The premise is the same. In terms of
you teach spoon bending.
Absolutely, and I think in terms of, you know, exposing magic tricks, it comes down to what's the motivation for doing that and which tricks are being exposed. So I am actually quite a fan of secrecy in terms of magic. I have a big background in magic. I'm a member of the Inner Magic Circle. And the last thing I would want this to be is a book of secrets being told to the general public. So in the instances where I do expose a trick, and spoon bending is one of them, the public are encouraged to play with that. It's sort of treated like mini experiments, to perform the trick one way and then the following day perform it another way and see the different impact it has on their audiences. So I don't think I'm giving away anything that would upset magicians, and also it's encouraging the public to experiment. I think where the upset within the magical community, to the extent there has been some, is from those people who are pretending to be psychic, who are and then upset that their life is much harder, because there's a whole chapter there explaining their secrets. And it's a personal call on that. Personally, I have, you know, very little time for people who are using magical secrets to fool others. They have abilities they don't have.
Well, there are magicians, bona fide magicians, not people who say they're psychic, but they say they're magicians. You know, you book them through talent agencies, whatever, who on the side, they also do, you know, they'll give you a reading or they'll do some psychic advice or something to make an extra buck. And those people are the ones that get riled up when you reveal these tricks, in addition to the people who are making strong claims as psychics.
Absolutely. And I think they just need to look at what they're doing to make a living and think about it very carefully. Mm. If you can fool people, either with a psychic reading or a magic trick, and it's more likely to be the former, actually, you have enormous power, because that person thinks, my goodness, here's someone who really can see into the future, or really does understand all about my past, even though we've only just met. And that means they will take your advice very seriously. And as a psychologist, you can't do that. You can't just a party be telling people how to live their lives, you know, because obviously that comes with responsibility. So I think that those people just need to think things through very carefully from a sort of ethical standpoint.
Mm. Well, and you talk about having enormous power. Some modalities in psychotherapy are very directive and exert a lot of power over their clients' lives, but that's a controversy within therapy, you know. So there are questions about the power dynamic in psychoanalysis, say. But that doesn't need to be a cleaned up problem for you to be zeroing in on this magician as advisor problem.
Absolutely, and you're right. Within therapy, it's or some forms of therapy, it's an issue. And for me, good therapy is when you're given the tools to solve the problem you have, and also problems you are likely to have in the future. With bad therapy, you're just given the advice, so that when you have a problem in the future, you have to come back to the therapist. And that's, of course, exactly what psychics are doing, saying, well, this is what you need to do now, and in the future, if there's a problem, just come back again, so you become reliant on them. So yes, there are, I think, very effective forms of therapy out there. I'm a big fan of cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. because it's about putting tools in the hands of the client. It's about empowerment. It's not about treating the therapist as some kind of god or guru who knows exactly what you should do, because that's just not how these things work.
So it should go without saying that you do not buy the kind of moral justification that some of these magician performers use when they're doing their fake psychic readings for an extra buck, when they say, hey, I'm no worse than the psychotherapist whose own methods are under question and don't have a lot of research to back them up, or maybe they make spurious claims. In other words, there's the justification that says, I'm just a poor man's psychiatrist. There's no difference in what I'm doing and what the shrink is doing down the road, except that I'm charging less and therefore maybe able to help more people.
You know, there might be some truth to that, but we just don't know. It's more likely they're the poor man's con artist. You know, they're just taking money from people and not offering what they say they're offering. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least with a counselor, good or bad, you know what you're getting, as it were. They're not sitting there, you know, using cold reading to convince you they have abilities they don't have. So I think it's a bizarre argument to say, hey, look, there are charlatans out there, so I'm only as bad as Lowe's, so I'm going to carry on. You know, everybody has to make those ethical and moral decisions, and I think if you can appear to do amazing stuff, that comes or should come with a sense of responsibility.
Richard, there's a lot more I wanted to talk about, and we're running short on time. I know you have another appointment. Do you mind coming back for another interview so we can cover more in your book? I really think this belongs in the hands of every, you know, self-respecting critical thinker and skeptic out there. I'd like to let our listeners know they could get a copy through forgoodreason.org. Is it fine with you? You come back for another episode?
I would be delighted to do that. And I should say, actually, that for me, the book coming out in the States is extremely exciting. We had real problems finding an American publisher. I mean, to the extent of 59 and Luck Factor and Quirkology instantly came out in the States. With Paranormality, it was very different, because they all said, look, you know, people just don't want to read about skepticism. So this is being put out on the Kindle primarily as a sort of self-published piece. And it's just a very exciting moment for that reason, because, you know, if it takes off, if it works, I think there's room for other skeptics, other scientists to be doing exactly the same thing.
That's fantastic. Thank you for joining me on For Good Reason, Richard Weissman.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to For Good Reason. To get involved with an online conversation about today's show, go to forgoodreason.org. The views expressed on the show aren't necessarily the views of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to info@forgoodreason.org. For Good Reason is produced by Brian Thompson and Thomas Donnelly and recorded from Los Angeles, California. For Good Reason's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-winning Gary Stockdale. Carrie Poppy also contributed to today's show. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.